You're listening to the Wool Academy podcast. This is episode number 18.
Hello and welcome. My name is Elizabeth Van Delden, and once a week we talk to an industry expert from the wool industry supply chain, from farm to fashion and beyond, delivering strategies and insights to be successful in wool and showcasing those beautiful stories wool has to tell.
Today on the show, we welcome Jeff Kingwell, who is based in South Africa, where he runs a farm producing merino sheep, angora goats and beef cattle. Jeff is chairman of the IWTO Sustainability Committee and serves in the working groups dealing with animal welfare and the environmental credentials of wool. Jeff is also a past chairman of both Cape Wool South Africa and the Western Cape branch of the National Wool Growers Association. Currently, he serves as vice chairman on the board of BKB, a wool broker business. Hello, Jeff. It's great to speak to you today. How are you and how are your sheep doing?
Hi, Lisa. They're doing very well. We've just had some lovely rain in 2017. We had a very tough 2016, particularly towards the end of the year. It was very, very dry. The last time we was dry as this was in the early 90s. But 2017 has been good, and when the grazing's good, the sheep are happy.
That's good to hear. Well, let's just get started with our first question, and I would like to ask you give us a little bit of background about yourself.
I grew up in the Karoo, close to where I'm living now. My father's still living there, and he grew up there as well. When I came back farming, my grandfather was still farming with my father on that farm. I trained as a mechanical engineer and worked for about 6 years as an engineer before I came back farming at about the age of 30.
And what? So we hear that your family has been involved in sheep farming for a very long time. What made you decide to also go into sheep farming, like your father and also your grandfather before?
I think growing up on a farm gives you a love and a passion for this lifestyle. Fortunately, I had the opportunity that there was a business I could come back to. So there are plenty of people who would love to farm, I suppose, who don't have the opportunity. In my case, I had the passion and the love and the opportunity. Obviously, I had an alternative career. I could have stayed working in the engineering field. And I clearly remember my grandfather saying to me, are you sure you want to come back farming? Because it's a way of life. It's not necessarily the best way to make money. But I've never regretted the decision. I think it's a lovely place to have a family, to raise your children. And I really enjoy stock farming. I enjoy working with animals.
And your engineer degree is also helping you on the farm every day, I guess?
Definitely. Obviously, you know, in engineering, you tend to specialize and you don't necessarily use that specialist knowledge, but the general background knowledge that you picked up and the experience does help you. I was quite lucky that early in my career as an engineer, I was involved with project management, and that is definitely very translatable to other businesses, including farming. And so I suppose I was fortunate that I didn't become a real specialist in a very small area, because that most probably wouldn't have translated quite so well into quite a generalist type of work that is the task of a stock farmer.
Yeah. And tell us a little bit more about your sheep and your farm so that people can picture it a little bit more.
Okay, the farm is in the Karoo, northwest of Graaffreinet. Rainfall of between 250 and 300 millimeters a year. The farm varies basically between 1450 meters above sea level up to about 2000. We have warm summers. We don't get as hot as many other places, and very cold winters. We farm with merino sheep, Angora goats and beef cattle, and think that in this environment they complement each other very well.
So if you say 200 to 300 milliliters of rainfall a year, so that's a semi-desert. And what do the sheep eat? How should we imagine the countryside?
Okay. Yes, I think you could accurately describe it as a sort of a cold semi-desert, particularly in the winter. The vegetation is a mixture of shrubs and grass, and on the higher mountains, the grass is fairly sour. And that is some of the benefit of our area. It is a very good area to farm with sheep, is that mixture of vegetation and mixture of diet that the animals have. And with the fact that you're semi-desert, we are quite drought-prone, so that is one of our challenges. But by the same token, like now when we've had rain, the countryside is very good for sheep farming, and you tend to, all over the world, you effectively, as your rainfall goes down, your stocking rate goes down. So you basically just carry the number of animals that the environment can sustain, depending on the rainfall and the climatic conditions you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for giving a little bit more detail. And also, can you tell us a little bit, what does a typical day look like for you?
Yeah, I don't really know if I have a typical day. It's a bit like asking what our average rainfall is, because it is so variable that it's very difficult. But yes, we have, in South Africa, we have staff on the farm that help us. In other words, there is a reasonable amount of availability of labor. So I tend to organize the day in the morning. With my involvement with off-farm activities that you mentioned in the introduction, Lisa, I tend to have to spend more time, as probably in the office, than the average farmer. But on certain days, we tend to move stock reasonably quickly. We ascribe to the holistic way of management. So most days, there will be stock that need to be moved and counted, so that we maintain control and check that there's nothing wrong. And at the same time, there'll be inspection of the stock while we're doing that. And then there'll be the detailed type of work. Some days it'll be inoculation, some days it'll be maintenance, and then we do have a little bit of irrigation. At times we have water, so there's a little bit of that sort of work involved as well.
Okay, so you spend a lot of time outside on your farm as well as inside in your office. So,
yeah. It's quite a good mix.
Yeah.
I'm always a happier person when it moves towards the outside away from the inside.
Yeah, and obviously you also used the term that your farm is your business. And tell us a little bit about what are the different income streams for your business.
All right, well, the Merino sheep, particularly in South Africa, are very much dual-purpose sheep. And so the income split between meat and wool, depending on the relative prices and also on your lambing percentages and things like that, will vary, I would say, between 60% to 70% meat. In other words, more meat than wool, and the remainder will be wool income. At the current high wool prices, it's moving towards a 60-40 split, but we still tend to get more income from meat. On the Angora goat side, they are much more a fiber-dominant enterprise, and so I suppose about 80% of your income there is on the fiber side. They grow slower, they don't produce as much meat. And then on the cattle side, well, it's all, the income is all meat. But we don't just sell animals for slaughter. From time to time, we do also sell breeding stock, so that would be a source of income as well.
And something I learned the other day is farmers tend to not necessarily say how many sheep or livestock they have, because it's almost like telling someone what is the amount on your bank account, because the livestock is what you depend on, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. I don't suppose I mind telling people, but I also don't normally offer that information up, because it's not so much a secretiveness thing, but I suppose we're not always comfortable speaking about how big your business is. You don't want to come across as if you're bragging about it.
Yeah, exactly. No, I thought that was quite an interesting aspect of farming. And when you look at the challenges in your business, what is the biggest challenges for the wool growing side of your business?
Basically, the biggest challenges are looking after the animals, and I'll put it into two main areas, and that is maintaining good nutrition under all climatic conditions. As I said earlier, we have a very variable climate. As you get drier, your climate does become more variable, and with that, the nutritional level of the grazing becomes more variable. And then the other big challenge is predation. And so they're both ongoing ones. I suppose the nutrition one is a little bit easier to manage, because it doesn't dry off overnight, so you can sort of see it coming. But our main predators here are the black-backed jackal and the caracal, or in the common name we call it the red cat. And they also give us a lot of trouble at times. At other times, it's not so much of a problem, but they definitely a huge cost to the business. And it's not something that we're ever going to, in my opinion, get under control. It's going to be an ongoing battle with how we manage our predators and effectively keep our predation losses down so that they don't catch our animals.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for sharing those insights. And we already heard from you in the introduction that you have been very active within the national wool industry in South Africa, and you have also been an active member and still are on international level in various working groups of the International Wool Textile Organization. What is your motivation behind your active leadership and engagement for the wool industry?
By and large, wool growing is a relatively, it's done in relatively small businesses. So the best way for wool growers to achieve anything is to work together. And that's why, so you start off by being part of your local wool growing organization. In our case, it's the National Wool Growers Association in South Africa. And through that, you try and achieve things, lobby for things, change things, but it's a mouthpiece where these small little businesses can get together and speak as one. I suppose in terms of motivation, Lisa, I believe one should try and do more than just look after yourself. And I'll get energized when I'm involved in some of these joint things, if I feel I'm making a difference. You know, if you feel you offering up your time and you're not achieving anything, well, that does make it difficult to stay motivated. But while you're making a difference, it's not that difficult. So it is a big cost to me in terms of time. The flip side of it is enriching. You meet new people, you get exposed to new things. So it's not all cost. There's definitely benefits, and through that also helps you to be motivated and excited about it.
Yeah, and speaking about, you know, meeting other people, what kind of benefits do you see? Obviously, when you are at these international events, or also on national level, you meet a lot of different industry members along the supply chain. What are the benefits for wool growers to connect to these other people within the wool industry?
I suppose if you put in a single word, it's all about communication. Wool has a very long pipeline, so different parts of the wool chain / pipeline are far removed from each other. But are they also geographically far removed, because a very small percentage of the South African clip actually gets processed in South Africa, an even smaller percentage actually gets consumed in South Africa. So there's, without getting together at these international forums, there's going to be a great disconnect between the different parts. The wool growers won't be talking to the processors, the spinners, or the brands, or the consumers, and they also won't know the challenges. And so I think that the big benefit is simply to get communication going. The growers then know exactly what it is that people want, and the people, the brands and the consumers and the people at the far end of the pipeline also have a better understanding of what it is possible for the growers to do and to deliver, and what, and if there are demands that are so onerous that they will effectively put people out of business and therefore cut off the supply of wool, and through that you most probably get to achievable solutions.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think it was always eye-opening whenever all the different supply chain members met and actually started to understand each other's issues and problems, and how only together you could find solutions. And another thing that you mentioned earlier is that you use holistic management on your farm. And that's another question I wanted to get to, is that one of the criticisms of the wool industry, or also like having sheep, is that it uses up too much land and that sheep supposedly contribute to desertification. But I had the chance of visiting you on your farm a few years ago, and you showed me the work you were doing against desertification by applying certain methods, and I'm thinking it's this holistic management you were just talking about earlier, to reverse desertification. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Definitely. In my opinion and in my experience, well-managed livestock reverse desertification. So I don't think we can deny that farmers have made mistakes in the past. I don't think that any of those mistakes were made willfully. In other words, most farming businesses are family businesses, and there's a desire to improve the business so that you can hand it over to the next generation if they're interested in carrying on. And with that as background, no one willfully destroys the resource, which is actually the grazing. We have more knowledge nowadays, and so some of the mistakes I think that were made in the past can really be attributed to lack of knowledge. The principles that we apply is to graze reasonably intensively for short periods of time, so that we give the plants a lot of time to recover. The theory behind that is you're trying to mimic what would have happened in this area before people were managing livestock, where there were large herds of herbivore antelope that had predators around them, and they would stick together in large herds, graze a small area intensively, and then move on once that had been grazed or effectively mucked by dust and dung and urine. And so we're trying to mimic that because we feel that that's how it used to happen. And there's no doubt that if you do that correctly, we're seeing the improvement, we're seeing species change, we're seeing better coverage happening. And when you do it for long enough, you even see your carrying capacity going up. I think when people talk about wool growing using too much land or too much water, you've got to look at what could you have used that land for alternatively. It's not as if that water, for example, could have been used to grow vegetables. We're talking about a semi-desert that can only support grazing animals. So you're either going to grow fiber, or you're going to grow meat, or you're going to run game. And that's about the limit that you can do here. And game farming in our area is definitely less environmentally friendly. The game can't move on the way they used to in the old days. So even when there are large game farms, they are still restricted in that area. And because you can't control the movement of game the way you can with livestock, you can't practice this intensive grazing where you graze a relatively small area quite intensively for a short period of time and then give it a long time to recover and then move around your farm. The game are all over the farm and they tend to concentrate on the better places and damage them and not really use the other places. So when you see game farming in our area, it's definitely a worse choice in terms of the environment. And so the system where you penalize people for using a lot of land and a lot of water is flawed, because you're not saying, well, what else could I have done with that water? Makes sense if that water could have been used to grow vegetables or something like that. But this is water that is simply falling on the land. It wasn't going to run off in any case. And the better we manage our land, the less of it will run off. And that shouldn't create a penalty in the systems that rate how much water you use for growing wool.
Okay, I even learned something new. I didn't know this whole aspect in comparison to game farming, so thank you very much for explaining that. And there was another thing that I observed when I was visiting you on your farm, is that you were planning to have wind turbines on your property. How is that project coming along, and is that something that many wool growers in South Africa look into more and more?
Yes, so It's still in the planning stage. There are a number of people who already have turbines up. So effectively, it's a little bit beyond your control, because if you happen to have a farm that has good wind, in other words, you've got a good resource, then it's a possibility. And for a lot of people, it's not a possibility. Unfortunately, in South Africa now, there's a little bit of a political struggle happening about renewable energy, where the monopoly energy producer Eskom is not wanting to add renewables to the grid at the moment, and as a result there's a bit of a stalemate. Our project is advanced to the point where the testing's been completed, the environmental impact study's been completed, but it can't progress any further until there's a possibility of getting a purchase agreement from the national energy supplier, which is Eskom. And so, yes, we're in a bit of a stalemate. I think long term it'll still happen. I don't see it happening in the foreseeable future or in the near future, at least. Yeah.
Okay, well then we'll keep an eye on that project and wish you good luck, that things will change in the positive direction for you. Before we close, how can the wool industry do more for farmers like yourself to be successful? Is there something you would like to see more?
Well, I think it fits in with what I said earlier, where you... the wool industry needs to work together. So I gave a reason why we as farmers need to work together, because we're all relatively small businesses. And as you go down the pipeline, the businesses tend to become bigger and can do more of their own promotion or their own research. But I think we need to work together internationally. I think we need to promote wool in the broad sense, and that means also doing research so that we can prove some of these attributes, like the sustainability of wool and things like that. And the only way we're going to do this is by working together. So what I would like us to see us doing as a whole industry is all parts of the industry getting together and pooling resources, both time and money, to achieve this, because our competition are doing that. In many cases, particularly on the synthetic fibers, where there are very big companies that produce the raw material, they sort of drive that process. Our production is a little bit more scattered, but by the same token, if you don't get out there and inform people about the positive attributes of wool, where are they going to learn about it? So we definitely need to work together, pool our money, pool our time, and keep on promoting a fiber that we know and believe has wonderful attributes, but we can't keep that hidden from our consumers.
Well, those are good words to close this episode. Before we say goodbye, what is the easiest way for people to connect with you?
I think email. Email would be the easiest. And I think you've got my email. Will you just add it there?
Yeah, perfect. Okay, thank you so much, Jeff, for your time. I really appreciate it. I'm guessing now it's quite hot because it's summertime in South Africa, and you will all rest during the hot time, but then you have to go back outside and get some work done.
Yeah, well, it's actually cooled off a little bit. As I mentioned to you earlier on, we've had a reasonably wet 2017, and that's been the reason. So normally February would be very hot, and because we've had a bit of rain, there's a bit more cloud cover. So December was exceptionally hot, but January and February haven't been that bad. But you're right, we at this time of the year, we tend to start work early in the cool of the day. You definitely don't want to be working with livestock at this time of the day, and have a long lunch break for the people and the animals, and then work in the afternoon again.
Yeah, well, I wish you a good day then, and thank you once again for your time.
Pleasure. Thanks, Lisa. Nice talking to you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode with Jeff Kingwill. If you want to find out more about Jeff, you can visit the show notes at elizabethvandelden.com/018. Once again, visit elizabethvandelden.com/018. Don't want to miss out on any of the future episodes? Then subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and also like us on Facebook at Elizabeth Van Delden. Thank you, and see you next week.